I want to thank the court for the opportunity to be here. It's been a few years since I have had the privilege. I hope I fare better this time than the last two or three times. The crux of this case, I believe, is first and foremost, perhaps the grant of a motion for leave to intervene, followed closely by the question of subject matter jurisdiction of a circuit court whenever there is another lawsuit involving the same subject matter, the same transactional dispute pending in a prior filed suit. In this particular case, Your Honors, we submit to the court that the appropriate thing that should have occurred was the grant of our motion for leave to intervene in the Circuit Court of the City of St. Louis, and then, following that, the Circuit Court to take up and consider in St. Louis our motion to dismiss the suit that was instituted there by the Missouri Attorney General as the transactional dispute in question, that is, whether ConocoPhillips had committed fraud by misrepresenting its status to the Petroleum Storage Tank Division Insurance Fund here in Missouri, and by virtue of it having had insurance and received millions of dollars of insurance settlements for pollution liabilities all over the country and never having reported it to the Petroleum Storage Tank Division here in Missouri.
Could you begin with whether you have an appealable judgment?
Yes. I believe that we do, Your Honor, because, in fact, the motion which we filed asking for amendment or alteration of the order denying intervention was timely. It was filed within 30 days of the order denying intervention, and we asked for the court to amend or alter its judgment. Now, as the record reflects, the Circuit Court of the City of St. Louis did not grant us hearing on that. Shortly following that, there was a judgment entered, what was called a judgment, approving a settlement, which we have, as indicated in the briefs, we believe that that is really not a judgment in terms of an adjudication of the merits. It was really approving a settlement, which the Attorney General worked out with ConocoPhillips just a few days later. We then filed a motion to alter or amend that judgment in a timely fashion, another authorized after-trial motion. Both the authorized motions were not heard, and in fact, the Circuit Court of the City of St. Louis struck our notice of hearing and said there would be no further proceedings. We filed a timely notice of appeal. Now, the notice of appeal was not a model of clarity, and I have to admit that. We should have said that we were seeking appeal from the order denying the intervention, which we sought. It did reference
that. Well, the question is, do you have a statutory provision that allows you to appeal from other than a final judgment?
Yes, Your Honor, there is, I believe, in the cases cited within our brief, this court has recognized that an order denying intervention, when intervention is asserted as of right, is an appealable order.
Right, but there's a difference between whether it's an appealable order and whether it is immediately appealable in an interlocutory appeal. And if it isn't authorized to be an interlocutory appeal, then it either has to be under normal precedent, it has to be from the final judgment in the case, or there has to be a designation by the trial court that this ruling is a final judgment for purposes of appeal.
The trial court ultimately did enter a judgment at the suggestion in the order to show cause issued by the Missouri Court of Appeals. They clearly were troubled by virtue of the fact that the order denying intervention, at least I believe this is what bothered them, the order denying intervention was not designated as a, quote, judgment under 7401A, I believe.
And it did not resolve all of the issues in the case, so it could not have been a final judgment.
Yes, and
there's only one judgment.
There was only one judgment, and I'm very familiar with the problems of trying to seek an appeal from an appealable order, and you can't get a trial court judge to call it a judgment or say.
I think the questions are more fundamental. Why weren't you right in appealing from the final judgment? Because an order denying intervention is merely an interlocutory order and not separately appealable, and therefore can only be appealed as part of an appeal of the judgment at the end of the case.
Well, I think under either circumstance, Your Honor, we should have been allowed to go forward with and consideration of the appeal rather than having it dismissed by the Court of Appeals in the Eastern District, because the order denying intervention would have been appealable as an interlocutory order. The judgment we should have been allowed to appeal, and we should have been allowed to have consideration of the standing, either or. It appeared to me at the time that we were in a situation where the Court of Appeals recognized we did not have a document titled judgment. I've been through at least three of those circumstances in other courts around the state in the last 20 months. And they've been very strict at the appellate court level, seemingly, about needing a document titled judgment.
Yep. Can there be multiple judgments in a single case?
Well, there can be multiple appealable orders, right, in a single case, and which under the rules now need to be denominated as a judgment. And this court has actually had some cases, which we've discussed in our brief in some length, I believe, which indicates that in fact the appropriate procedure on that is to determine whether or not the, if I may, review should be undertaken as an appellate court has a duty to freely exercise jurisdiction to provide review on the merits, and technical compliance with Rule 8108A is not in all instances mandatory or jurisdictional. I've been in a situation, as I was saying, in other cases, and this is similar, where the appellate courts say, well, we don't have anything called a judgment here, and therefore we're throwing the appeal out.
Are these also intervention cases?
No, they were not. They were not intervention cases. But they were cases,
The final judgment that was entered in this case necessarily reaffirm the trial court's all of the trial court's previous rulings in a case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't.
Yeah, doesn't the final judgment entered in this case after the settlement, doesn't that in some sense necessarily the trial judge reaffirming all of its prior orders and decisions?
Yes.
Because it would have jurisdiction for 30 days after that to redo anything, presumably on its own motion, even without motion of the parties.
Yes. And our after-trial motion, our post-judgment motion, whenever the court signed the document called judgment, was timely, and we did attach the only document called judgment that we had to the notice of appeal, which is, you know, from experience, I know if you don't have that, then very quickly you're told that this is not an appealable order and you need to show cause why you're entitled to go forward. In another situation, not necessarily relevant to this case, but as an example, I have actually been told by another appellate court that you need to go and seek a writ and try to get the trial court judge to call it a judgment. And try that route. I did that. Of course, then the writ was denied after I was told that that's what we needed to do. But in any event, that's...
You only have about 3.5 minutes left. Did you want to address why you think you should have been allowed to intervene as of right and why you meet the requirements of the rule to do so?
Yes, Your Honor. First, my client had a lawsuit pending in the Circuit Court of Greene County at the time the suit in the Circuit Court of the City of St. Louis was filed. ConocoPhillips was the defendant. The claim was based upon it unlawfully obtaining money from the Petroleum Storage Tank Insurance Fund, and Judge Cordonier in Greene County had previously entered an order saying my client, or had previously denied a motion to dismiss for lack of standing on the part of my client. What the Circuit Court in the City of St. Louis did was, I guess, engage in a review of that and decide that maybe that was the wrong decision. I do not believe a Circuit Court in St. Louis or anywhere else is entitled to review.
Wasn't the Greene County suit removed to federal court and then dismissed?
It was removed to federal court, and all of that was and it was still pending at the time the suit in St. Louis was filed.
But ultimately that case was dismissed, so there was no case pending in Greene County.
There was no case pending in Greene County.
The opposing counsel says that means even if the St. Louis case originally should have deferred to the Greene County case, it became the only case, and therefore there is no problem.
Only if you would buy into the notion that there'd be such a thing as springing jurisdiction or breathing life into a second and subsequently filed suit. As we mentioned in our brief, the United States Supreme Court has said, and I believe this court is probably of the same mind, that subject matter jurisdiction depends upon the nature of the way things are at the time of the filing. Our position is the suit in St. Louis was dead on arrival. It could not be revived by virtue of some hypothetical jurisdiction or...
Are you familiar with our decision in the Webb case where we said subject matter jurisdiction simply deals is very narrowly read and circuit courts of subject matter jurisdictions of civil actions? Other things go to the court's authority to act as opposed to their subject matter jurisdiction?
I am familiar with that, Your Honor, and I think that there's still room to discuss the notion of subject matter jurisdiction. The constitutional provisions granting circuit courts subject matter jurisdiction, as interpreted in the Webb case and otherwise, still leaves room for deciding whether or not just because a circuit court in McDonald County has subject matter jurisdiction generally of a dispute, if there are two other suits pending in other circuits, I do not believe that the circuit involving the same subject matter, the same dispute, I do not believe that it's appropriate for a second or a third circuit court to say, I have constitutional subject matter jurisdiction here and I can proceed and I do not need to abide by or even acknowledge the existence of other suits in the circuit courts of this state. To do so would promote, as we've argued, the type of hypothetical jurisdiction, leapfrogging, getting a place in line, encouraging litigants to engage in the type of forum shopping, and that's what was going on here. The state of Missouri and certainly ConocoPhillips were not happy with what amounted to ultimately two rulings by two separate circuit court judges that my client had standing. Now, the second one came after what we said is the dead-on-arrival suit in St. Louis. And that had already been decided before we showed up before the circuit court in St. Louis, indicating that the intervention should be allowed and dismissal of the suit there.
I apologize. In looking at our little warning lights, it appeared we went from green to red without going through the 3 minute of yellow to give you an indication. So I just want to alert other attorneys that you may need to watch the actual time. So you finished well, and we'll hear from you on rebuttal, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I intend to address the procedural questions and leave to Mr. Burhans the question of intervention in a suit essentially asserting a claim against his client. Or to put it a different way, I'm going to address the things that were in the transfer motion, and he's going to address what's actually in the brief. First off, in the reply brief, there's a suggestion that there never really was a final judgment in this case, that it was a so-called judgment, merely an approval of a conditional settlement between the parties. No, it was a final judgment, as that term is used in 512.020. There was a dismissal with prejudice. That's certainly a final judgment. The question then becomes, first, whether the notice of appeal was sufficient to raise before this court the question of intervention. And there is a long-standing set of cases in the Court of Appeals saying that you have to actually list in the notice of appeal a prior order, if you're going to assert that or argue about that on appeal. The notice of appeal said it was not a model of clarity. Actually, it was very clear. It just listed the final judgment itself.
Did it say that it was he was attempting to appeal the denial of intervention?
It said nothing about that.
It doesn't have to, though, that there's no requirement that in the notice of appeal you have to say what the errors are. It just has to say what order or judgment you're appealing
from. It does say what order or judgment you're appealing from, and the only order or judgment he listed was the December 11th order, and in fact, he does not in his brief assert error in the December 11th order, or he can't get to the question of error in December 11th order because what he's really got to do is reverse the November 13th order.
But Judge Fisher asked the question, and if in fact the denial of the right to intervene was an interlocutory order, then it became a final order when the December judgment was entered, and that would be the correct judgment to appeal from.
Well, I will agree with the first part of that it became final at the time that a final judgment was entered in the case. And the statute says you can appeal when there's a final judgment in the case.
Correct.
I don't agree with the second part, which is that automatically when you appeal from the final judgment, everything before that is fair game.
So do I have to, in my notice of appeal, list every order with which I disagree? So if I was denied the right to do more interrogatories, or I was denied the right to do anything in the case, each of those are separate orders that have to be listed?
If
or are those interlocutory and then included in your appeal from the
final judgment? The rule in the Court of Appeals consistently has been that if you're going to appeal from some order other than that one you listed, you have to list that as well.
But,
and let me give you an example of why that matters.
Can you answer the question I asked,
okay,
though? Do you have to appeal for every interlocutory order entered in a case by a judge?
Any decision that you are going to challenge in your brief, that's the holding of the Court of Appeals. Consistently, you have to list that.
So if, even rulings on objections?
If that's what you're going to appeal from and it is an order, then you would have to do that.
Is that holding supported by the rules, the language in the rules?
Oh, I don't know. The language in the rule says that you would have to specify the judgment or order appealed from.
Exactly.
And so here's the problem if you open the door to that. A week or so ago, you decided the Macon County Emergency Services case. If you can simply list the final order and then raise anything in that case, then in the brief by the Emergency Services Board, they could have said, oh, and the dismissal of the Director of Revenue that I got by driving to Macon and appearing before the judge personally and doing that, well, that's at issue too. Now, that wasn't said. There was nothing in the notice of appeal about that. So they could have then said in the brief that we're going to bring you back in.
Don't we rely on the motion for new trial and other post-trial motions for preservation issues? Or it seems like you're suggesting that you could absolutely preserve everything all the way through, even in a properly filed post-trial motion, but you can't really just file a notice of appeal on the final judgment.
That's what the Court of Appeals decisions say, at least what I believe that they say.
It would make our job a lot easier if that's adopted.
Well, and the Court of Appeals has found its job easier because
shorter.
Of that.
but can they... they're not the ones that promulgate the rules, is that correct? Has this court ever held that?
No, this court has never held that. And that's certainly true. This court has never held that. I don't know if the court has ever been asked about that. The question then, assuming that you can reach beyond that, becomes whether the question that Judge Breckenridge posed, whether this party has an appealable judgment. And frankly, this is a little bit beyond the brief, I think that's a difficult question. This court and other courts have not only said that a denial of intervention is appealable, but that it is immediately appealable. And yet...
What case out of this court said it's immediately?
Well, this court didn't say it was immediately appealable. I think it's the Reser case. This court said you can't do it by writ because you can appeal.
Right, but that case doesn't hold it's immediately
No, the Court of Appeals has held it's immediately appealable. The logic in Reser is, well... I think the logic suggests that it's immediately appealable because otherwise what you've created is the possibility that years later the court reverses the decision on intervention and the whole thing has to be unwound because they were entitled.
So what is the statutory authority for that holding under 512? Is there anything that allows that to
be I think that's the problem because 512 only allows an appeal by a party aggrieved by a judgment. Actually, the plaintiff here, or the appellant here, was never a party. So I'm not even sure.
You're suggesting it's in the nature of a permanent judgment. If there was a permanent judgment that excluded a proper party from a case, that there's no law allowing for a review by an appellate court.
The only statute that allows review is for a party to a suit. If you treat the suit as being the suit between the Attorney General and ConocoPhillips, then Mr. Wagner was never a party. If you treat the suit as being between Mr. Wagner and the other two, the final judgment in that was the day of the intervention was denied.
So under your view of the world, then, it is possible that a proper party who was never allowed to participate in a case would never have the right, past asking the circuit judge to rule on that, to participate.
If this court says that when the legislature used the word party, It means someone who has been, who has appeared as a party in the case. That is the necessary result.
And doesn't that mean research wrong, that you can't have a writ because it said there was an appeal? But
yes, that would mean research wrong.
Unless we were to broadly read the word party to include those who should be parties if the court were incorrect and we would have to determine.
Or read the suit as meaning the dispute between the intervener and the parties in the case.
But that's not a separate lawsuit. That's part of this, the
that's,
broader
lawsuit. That's the problem with
it. I'm trying to think of the name of the case that was the education fund that dealt with when you have a final judgment and justiciable units. And under that case, there it anticipates that there are holdings that resolve all the disputes between different persons in the lawsuit, but they still are not final for purposes of appeal unless they are designated as such and they resolve a justiciable unit. Barring a designation, you appeal them when there's the final judgment in the case.
And that is done by Rule 7401 B, which deals with multiple claims. And for that, we have to have more than one claim for relief presented in an action, except that there isn't more than one claim for relief presented in this action. So I don't know that that rule even applies.
And that contemplates all of them being parties.
Excuse me?
That contemplates everybody being parties.
It does. The whole, all of B contemplates the way it is worded, it only applies to parties. It's very difficult to take this square peg of intervention and fit it into the round hole.
If an intervener is not a party, then they would have no right to appeal under any rules or statutes, as you're reading.
I've not taken that position in the brief. I don't want to take that position, but I'll tell you, after having spent a fair amount of time on this brief and preparing for argument, I think that the rules and maybe the statute with regard to intervention and appeals are problematic.
And the denial of intervention is only appealable when it is a right to intervention as a matter of right.
Yes.
Again, that would preclude protecting a person's interest and would require reversal of reser and a writ.
Well, not reversal, because it really is kind of dicta in reser, but it would be different than, certainly it would be different than the case law that addresses immediate appeal if there's a denial of intervention.
Mr. Layton, before we move on to the merits, Mr. Wagner's merits, he spends a great deal of time and energy challenging the standing of the Attorney General.
Yes.
And it strikes me that the caption of the case is a bit strange in that it's State Expel AG and the PISTF Board. Who's the real party in interest?
I suspect that was done because the statute dealing with PISTF actually says the department may request either the attorney general or a prosecuting attorney to bring any action authorized in this section in the name of the people of the state of Missouri. And so I think that is the place that they looked in determining how to caption the suit.
But the interest the AG is advancing is the interest of the PISTF board.
Of the fund.
And their responsibility to the people.
Yes. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and thank you. The intervention order should be upheld because Mr. Wagner failed to satisfy any of the three requisite elements required for intervention as a matter of right under 5212A. Namely, Mr. Wagner failed to demonstrate that he had an interest that was of an immediate or definite nature warranting intervention. The interest proffered is that maybe someday, if he were to experience a loss that was covered and incurred coverable reimbursable expenses, that maybe the fund might not be able to pay on that claim because of a result of this action, namely that now it has become a settlement. Well, that's just too speculative under the case law. He has no direct interest. When you look at what occurred here, Mr. Wagner experienced no claim, was not denied a claim, had no underlying knowledge of the transactions at issue. He's completely unconnected to any of the events or circumstances of this case. Now, he also failed to demonstrate that he was so situated that the ability to impair his the ability to protect his rights would be impaired. Well, first of all, his interest is too tenuous, as I just stated. But with respect to impairment of rights, Mr. Wagner still has the ability if he experiences a covered loss under this, what's essentially an insurance program, he can make that claim. Separately, if he has some other additional claim against the state or against the fund trustees or against my client, he's free to make those claims. There is no impairment of that ability under the intervention order that was
ordered. You're saying if the settlement was a bad settlement and a neglect of duty, he could sue them for that, but he can't intervene in the underlying settlement to scratch it?
Your Honor, I'm not so sure he can settle because it's a bad settlement, as the case law that we discuss in our brief suggests. Mere disagreement with the settlement is not cause for intervention. However, there is no claim, there's no allegation, there's no pleading that this was a bad settlement or that there was some collusion. There's been some lawyer talk kind of thrown around in the briefs, but there's no pleading that says that. There's no case that makes that claim. That's separate and apart from what we're here to address today. Now, the last issue that Mr. Wagner was required to prove and didn't prove was that his interests would be inadequately represented. And here we have the statutorily designated trustees of the fund who are empowered by statute to vindicate and protect the interests of the fund. That means adjudicating or determining claims. That means whether they file a lawsuit or decide not to file a lawsuit. That means entering into settlement agreements. In addition to the trustees for the fund, the Attorney General has statutory authority, both generally and under the UST fund specifically, to bring claims on behalf of the fund. Those interests have been adequately represented. The Attorney General effected a settlement that recovered nearly half of the amounts at issue without the risk of uncertain and costly litigation. Now, as I just noted, Mr. Wagner disagrees with the settlement. He thinks maybe he could have gotten a better deal. Well, maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. The fact that he knows nothing about the case and his deposition testimony referenced in the record shows all he knew about the case is what his lawyers told him. He didn't suffer a claim. He didn't have knowledge as to what the underlying issues were. He didn't have knowledge as to the underlying facts. I submit that that would be an improper or an inadequate representative versus the trustees or the Attorney General in this case. So there are three points that Mr. Wagner had to prove under 5212A that he failed to prove. And the court, by contrast, made findings based upon substantial evidence in the record that he was not the proper party and that his rights would not be impeded. And that evidence simply can't be overturned with the argument that's raised in the briefing. And I want to submit, Your Honors, that there is an important policy consideration here to consider. There are over 1,900 tank owners that participate in the fund. If Mr. Wagner is correct, and if the fund can be opened up to any owner or operator of a tank to participate in this process, the system would collapse. After Mr. Wagner intervenes, then Mr. Smith, then Mrs. Jones, and then Ms. Robinson, and so on and so on. The system was not designed to do that. The system was set up so that you have, in effect, what is a state agency that has appointed trustees that are answerable to the state and are charged with the responsibility to effect the best purposes and protect the interests of the fund.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The merits argument that's presented here by ConocoPhillips has been twice presented in the Circuit Court of Greene County, Missouri, and twice rejected, and ultimately was presented in part on their argument in the Circuit Court of the City of St. Louis seeking to obtain an order denying our intervention, and the Circuit Court of the City of St. Louis, although made aware of two previous rulings by a court of completely concurrent jurisdiction, decided to do something different. And I do not think that the Circuit Court in the City of St. Louis is entitled to review decisions of another circuit court in another part of the state.
We can review what circuit courts do, though. So can you tell us why it was right or wrong in its ruling?
Why he was wrong in his ruling? Okay. Yes. First of all, my client had a definite interest that had been recognized by another court, both as a taxpayer and as a beneficiary of a fund that is governed by the Missouri Uniform Trust Code. And that claim had been asserted. Secondly, my client's interest was clearly not protected by the ongoing litigation in the Circuit Court of the City of St. Louis, if you could call it litigation. They really did nothing for about 18 months after the suit was filed. And that, I think, is evidenced by the circumstances here. They never wanted my client involved in the lawsuit in St. Louis, and the parties there wanted to try to effect a resolution of the matter, and they clearly were not interested in protecting my client's interests in the matter, and indeed made arrangements and suggested to the circuit court in St. Louis that court not even hear my post-order, post-judgment motions, which the court refused to do until the Court of Appeals later said maybe you need to go back and ask him to sign something called a judgment, which we did. Now, I think under those circumstances, it's pretty clear that the parties, original parties in the circuit court of the city of St. Louis, were not looking to protect the interest of my client and I think the interest that should have been advocated. The state, there were some questions mentioned here, I do not believe that the Attorney General's office ever should have been involved in this case, and I believe there was some question by Judge Wilson in that regard. This is a fund that has no sovereign immunity. It doesn't handle state money. Its liabilities are not liabilities of the state of Missouri.
And does the statute give it authority to act that
statutes,
Mr. Layton cited?
The statutes speak to that directly. They also say that the fund has a fiduciary obligation. Mm-hmm. And any fund, imposed with a trust obligation, is under the Missouri Uniform Trust Code a statutorily created trust, and its beneficiaries are interested parties entitled to bring claims. So, in view of all of that, I think that the settlement, which was conditional in and of itself, because they made specific provisions for unwinding it in case we wound up in this court or some other court and it was determined that the Circuit Court of St. Louis did not have jurisdiction. They anticipated this. They anticipated, and it's clear from their own, quote, settlement document.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.